After 8 years of economic growth and unparalleled prosperity, we began to notice in the year 2000 that there was a little bit of a chink in what appeared to be the longest streak in financial history of success. And that chink began to widen as we rolled into the year 2001, and things that we thought would never happen, or at least in our short lifetime didn't expect to happen, was that businesses that were so prosperous and booming, particularly in Austin, would begin to look at the possibility of an economic downturn. Even the great Dell Computer began to lay off people, and that rippled through our community, and we saw things begin to change. For months and months and months, we saw homes selling for more and more and more. And then in August, we saw a decline in home sales. In fact, there was an 8% decline in home sales in August over a year ago August, and there are twice as many homes on the market today as there was a year ago. And that's an interesting phenomenon, especially if you're trying to sell a house. In addition to that, the layoffs continued around the country. And people began to ask the question, what really happened? Stock market began to slip, and all of this was taking place. Everybody seemed to be getting kind of nervous. The Feds lowered the interest rates and lowered them again and lowered them again, lowered them again to where now they're the lowest they've been in 39 years. And in the midst of all of that, we come to a crisis on September 11th, and people predominantly quit talking about the economy. No, it's still mentioned, but it's mostly mentioned by government officials who are encouraging you to go out and spend some money, get back to work, get things going again. But by and large, the populace of the United States really quit focusing on the economy. And I think that that's very telling. I think what that says to us is that we as a people, when there's no real crisis, have a tendency to focus on money as a primary issue of life. And then when we're faced with life and death issues, we stop focusing on that and say, you know, life is more important than money. But my fear is that will fade. And we might go back to business as usual, thinking that money makes the world go round. And in the face of that thinking, one of the terrifying realities is this. We cannot control our own financial destiny. The success or failure of our company, the up or down of the product in which we invest ourselves, the nature of the stock that we purchase or the value of the house, that's really not in our control. I mean, we can make good decisions, we can work hard, we can think well, but by and large, a lot of smarter people than us have done much more poorly than us when they began to believe that they could control the economic future of their world. And when we come to a crisis in our country like what we witnessed on September 11th, we recognize that though we may think that we're the captain of our financial fate, we're really not. And some of you have been hit with a layoff for the first time in your life, and you're scratching your head going, what happened to me? I never thought this would happen to me. I'm a good employee. I'm a smart individual. I work hard. How could this have ever happened to me? In the face of that, we understand, if we're thinking with our eyes open, we understand that if we're going to find some level of security when it comes to the area of money, we've got to look further than the economy, because the economy will go up and the economy will come down. There's got to be something more than that when it comes to having financial stability. Now, we started a series a couple weeks ago in the face of our crisis. We looked at the issue of national security and recognized that the government has a role in protecting its citizens, but the government cannot protect us completely from evil in the world. It's an impossibility. We must be prepared for that. Last week, we looked at eternal security, and we wrestled with the issue of truth. We look at what the terrorists say is true, and we call that evil. So that must mean that there are some absolute truths, some rights and some wrongs in the world, because if we're right about what they did, then they're wrong about what they did, even though they believe it with all their heart. And they think that they're in the presence of God today for killing people. And we would say hogwash to that. And if we would say hogwash to that, we have to admit that somebody's right about eternal life, somebody's right about heaven, someone's right about hell, and some people are wrong. And last week we asked the question, could it be possible that you might be wrong? And if it's possible that we could be wrong, what is right? So we looked at eternal security. Can you really know that you've got the right answer about God and life after death? Well, this week I want to talk about financial security. In the midst of our unstable world, how can you have financial security? How can you live in financial confidence? And let me suggest, this is my key statement. This is the main thing I want you to get today, so I'll state it up front. My key statement is this. Financial security is not about amount. It's not about amount, but about attitude. Financial security is not about amount, but it's about attitude. Some people believe if I can just get to a certain amount of money, a certain amount of income, a certain amount of position, a certain amount of possessions, a certain amount of money in retirement, a certain amount in the bank, then I'm going to be secure, and until I get there, I'm insecure, and I'm working toward an amount. What I would suggest to you is that's no way to live. You'll never gain financial security that way. The only way to gain real, true financial security is to have the correct attitude that will give you life and carry you through economic upturns and downturns that will make a difference to you regardless of how you live. And let me also say that as we look at the passage we're going to look at in just a moment, that this message is not just to the people who are earning a living. And I want to also speak to those who would be considered pre-wage earners. You know, you're the people who make your money primarily on your ability to get your parents to give it to you, okay? Some of you are very entrepreneurial in that area. You've learned how to cajole. You've learned how to pout. You've learned how to position yourself. You've learned how to pit mom against dad. And you're really excellent at getting a lot of money. Some of you are, you know, just basically poor. And you can't get anything out of them. But your relationship with mom and dad, I believe now more than ever, frequently hinges on your particular attitude toward money. Because many, many teens and young adults view mom and dad as either the means to their financial and therefore popular success, or the one who's standing in their way. And frequently money, boiling down to our teenagers and our young adults, frequently money becomes a huge wedge in relationship between parents and kids. And it shouldn't be that way. So you need to listen to what the Bible has to say. If you open your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 6, that's the passage we're going to be looking at this morning, not John 10, which is on your outline. So don't keep your finger in John 10 the whole morning thinking, when's he going to get to John 10? Okay, John chapter 6. We're going to be looking at a passage in John chapter 6, starting in verse 6, where Paul writes, "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." I did say 1 Timothy 6, didn't I? Man, I really messed up this morning. 1 Timothy 6, 6 and following. Okay, let me read it again since you're going to be looking at it now. Maybe we need more lights in the house. Why don't you raise the house? Yeah, that's better. Okay, now I can see your face. Okay. Verse 6, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." Now, as we look at this passage, I want to state right up front so you get it, you get very clear, this is not about amount. So if you're sitting there and you've got a better than six-figure income and you got a big house and you got you know, whatever. I'm not necessarily talking specifically to you, or if you're saying, you know, I live in a little tiny one-bedroom efficiency and, you know, my clunker will barely run, I'm not talking to you. This is about attitude, okay? So what's your attitude? First question we have to ask and answer is, what am I living for? What am I living for? What is it that life is about for me? Is life about the acquisition of power through finances, of possessions through finances, of popularity through finances, of personal achievement through finances? Is that the driving force of my life? When I think about where my time goes, where my focus goes, where my energy goes, where my best emotional, physical, mental energy goes, is it primarily around the acquisition of things? Is it primarily around what I can accumulate in financial resources? Is that what I'm living for, or am I living for something else? Paul suggests that it ought to be godliness with contentment. The word godliness, let me define it for you. Godliness refers to a consistent, authentic relationship with God that manifests itself in me beginning to take on His characteristics. It's a consistent, authentic connection, relationship with God that manifests itself that I'm going to begin to start living like Him or becoming like Him. In other words, I'm going to start thinking the way God thinks. I'm going to take on His attitudes. I'm going to start having the kind of relationships with other people that God has with other people. I'm going to start placing the values that God places on things the way God places the value on things. In other words, I'm going to start becoming like God, and He's going to kind of take over my life, and I'm going to start taking on His qualities and His characteristics. Paul said that's what we ought to be living for. That ought to be the focus of our life, not the stuff that we can acquire or accumulate. He goes on to say, but godliness with contentment is great gain. The word contentment is a word that means inner satisfaction. It means I have an inner satisfaction, an inner peace, an inner happiness that's not dependent on what I own. It's not dependent on what I have. In fact, I have that, and I'm satisfied with what I have, little or much. I can always be satisfied when I wake up in the morning and I look at my circumstances. I can say, you know, that's okay. That's good. I'm happy. I am at peace. I don't need more. This is good enough. If you take that focus that my life is about a connection with God and becoming like Him, and you add to that a relationship with the world where, you know, I really am satisfied. I can deal with what I have. And you put those two together, you have a powerful combination to have the right kind of attitude regardless of what the economy does. Regardless if you have a lot or if you have a little, that gives you life. So what are you living for? Second question we must ask and answer is, what can I live without? What can I live without? Oftentimes, we're asking the question, what do I need? When we really ought to be asking the question, what do I not need? Because we live in a commodity-rich culture. The options to capture your attention, the things out there that you could purchase and own, the quantities of stuff that are available to you are huge. They seemingly are unlimited. The question is not which of those things do I need, but which of those things do I not need? And Paul gives a real clear formula here for what needs are supposed to be. He says, first of all, what we need to do is learn the value of things. Learn the value of things. Look at verse 7. He says, for we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. Isn't that interesting? We brought nothing in the world. You never see a baby that comes out of the womb in a designer outfit. You know, grandma puts a designer outfit on as quickly as he can or she can, puts one on, but you don't see a baby born that way coming out of the womb with a fistful of cash. In the same way, you never see a hearse with a trailer hitch pulling a U-Haul, and everybody's, you know, the guy's possessions are in there. Well, you heard about the man that was so committed to his money. I mean, he worked all of his life, saved all his money, he stuck it in a bank, had all of his money in a bank. His wife swore that every dime he ever made went into that account. And so he's laying there on his deathbed, and he says to her, you know, honey, I'm not going to die until you make me a promise. And she says, well, what is it? He says, I want you to promise me that you're going to bury me with my money. Well, because he wouldn't die until she made a promise, she finally relented and promised that she would bury him with all of his money. And so after the funeral was over and the funeral director came and they were closing the casket for the last time, she said, oh, wait a minute, I got to put his money in the casket. And the funeral director looked at her and thought, what? And she walked up and they opened the casket back up and she reached in there and she laid a nice check right on top of him. And closed the casket and buried him with his money. Somehow I think that's a check that'll never be cashed. What's the point? What's he saying? Here's what Paul's saying. What Paul's saying is that nothing in this world, financially or materially, created your life. You came into this world without the aid of a house or a car, without the aid of a designer outfit, without the aid of a ring. In other words, life exists or life begins not with stuff. And when you leave this life, you're not going to take anything with you. You're going to go out empty-handed. And so the big issues of life, the beginning, death, the end of it, those two issues are bigger than anything that you will acquire along the way. In other words, the stuff that you can pick up on the journey that you didn't start out with and that you won't take with you has a limited value. It's not that it has no value. It's not that it means nothing, but it's limited in its value. And that's why people at a time of economic downturn are sending incredible amounts of money to charities in New York. At a time when people in the United States ought to be hoarding their money and saying, you know, I can't send any, I can't spend any money, I can't give anything because we've got this economic bad time. This is a time when people are being incredibly generous. Why? Because people intuitively understand that life issues are bigger than money. And yet oftentimes we slip back into that narrow focus and we start taking things and placing a value on them that God never intended them to have. We need to learn the value of things. Also, we need to adopt God's definition of need. We need to adopt God's definition of need. Look at verse 8. He says, but if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. What does it really take for you to live this day? You need the shirt on your back, the roof over your head, and a square meal on the table, right? I mean, really, that's really all it takes. It's all it really takes, right? I mean, you can live this day, you can survive. In fact, there are billions of people in the world that never expect any more than that. And they live their whole life never expecting any more than that. So what I really need is my basic necessities. Remember what Jesus prayed? When the disciples asked him to pray, he said, pray like this. He said, give us this day our what? Our daily bread. Now here's the key. If I understand that the basics are really all I need, then everything else is a blessing. And if I can get up in the morning and say, you know, I've got the basics covered. I've got my food, you know, I've got a roof over my head, I've got a shirt on my back, I've got the basics covered. Look at all this other stuff I have. What a blessing. I'm a very blessed person. Think how that would change your life. And so maybe your income does drop 20 or 30% during financial hard times. Maybe you go through a time when your stock portfolio doesn't do so well or your house price goes down in value. Who cares? It's more than what I need. It's okay. I can survive this. In fact, I can be happy with it because I rise in the morning. I've got the basics. Everything else is blessing. You see, with that kind of an attitude, godliness plus contentment, it's a powerful, powerful, powerful combination for life. In the world in which we live, there's a real push to change the basic meaning of everything from a want to a need. And we've got a multi-billion dollar industry called advertising that frequently tells you that you're a non-person or less than a person or less than a successful person if you don't buy the product. I don't know if you've noticed, very seldom does an advertiser actually talk about the quality of their product anymore. You know, buy this automobile, it'll get you 400,000 miles. Yeah, right. We know better than that. No, buy this automobile because you deserve it. Someone of your class, someone of your distinction. You know, and you're driving down the road in this automobile and everybody's looking at you like you're someone important. It's a self-esteem issue. It has nothing to do with the quality of the vehicle. And that whole industry, the advertising industry, intends to get beyond the head and into the heart and into the soul to make you feel like you need things. You know, the commercials for these breath mints. You know, what do? They got this picture of this man and this woman, and you can see the glow on their face, and they're just, you know, obviously having this incredible connection. One that you could only dream of, and, you know, the advertisement is use these breath mints. Now, for all the women here that are married or been proposed to once or twice or three times, how many times did a man ever look you in the eye and say, from the first time I met you, I just fell in love with your breath? Your breath swept me off my feet. For as long as you live, don't ever change your breath mints. Because that is what makes my heart beat for you. We say, that's absolutely ridiculous, don't we? But the breath mint commercial says, you know, buy these things and, man, you're going to connect with people. It's going to be powerful. And as much as we know that's not true, sometimes in our mind we get confused. And we think, you know, I've got to have this. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with breath mints. We're completely okay with you having good breath. Brush your teeth, floss, breath mints, avoid a little garlic every once in a while. Advertisers are not evil. They just understand that if they can move it from the head to the heart, if they can emotionally hook you, you're going to buy. And we ought to be smarter than that. Life doesn't consist in things. What are my needs? What are the things that I need? What are the things I do not need in order to live? One of the things that we're kind of wrestling with right now is the whole issue of our kids as they grow up. We get four of them, and they're expensive for some reason. I don't understand that. But yesterday, I did the typical dad thing. You know, it's one of those real unusual days. My son had a football tournament, so at 8 o'clock in the morning, he's playing football, and I'm at this football tournament, and it was one of those deals where it's double elimination, so as long as you don't lose two, you keep playing, and playing, and playing. You know, and they lost the first one, so I'm thinking, you know, it's that dad dilemma where, you know, I want my son to do good, I'm cheering for my son, but this could take a long time. So they lost the first one, I'm thinking, noon. But then they started winning, and they won, and they won, and they won, and they won. And they even beat the team that beat them in the morning, and so they were going to have to play that team again. And I get home in the late afternoon, and then another dad and I are taking our daughters to the UT volleyball game, where they got beat by Texas A&M. Knew we had a few Aggies in here. It's not really a good day to make that noise. Longhorns are very testy about this time. Not sure why, but I've heard that rumor. So we go to this volleyball game. We're watching the volleyball game, and then the discussion on the way home is, Dad, can I play club volleyball? Well, my daughter made the B team at Westwood as a freshman, and in order to make the JV team, we're being told that she needs to spend the rest of the year playing club volleyball. Well, I never knew what club volleyball was, but evidently all the other girls play club volleyball. And I found out just recently what that means, and what that basically means is this. You know what that is? That's a universal sign for Dad's pain. It's going to cost a lot of money. And I started thinking about this, and, you know, we've come such a long way in our society. where we've built huge athletic complexes so that from the very earliest age, our kids can have the finest opportunity to play all these sports. And we run from game to game to game and from practice, and we spend more and more money to make sure that our kids have a fair shake so that they can be great athletes for a very small percentage of them that may go through college on an athletic scholarship. But we have to do that because we need to do this for our kids. It's a need. And you know what saddens me? When was the last time you drove by a sand lot and saw a group of kids just playing for fun? You know, they don't do that anymore. You know why? Because it's not fun anymore. It's business. It's work. When was the last time you saw a group of dads out throwing the football with their sons, just having a good time relationally? Or dads and moms and sons and daughters out hitting the baseball together and playing a little game of baseball together? You know, we don't do that anymore. We've gotten beyond that. We've gotten sophisticated, we've gotten it organized, and we've gotten it expensive. And there are a lot of people that feel like that this is a need. If I don't put my kid in these environments and spend this kind of money, then I'm not a good parent. And so we've changed the word need in our culture to refer to lots and lots and lots of things beyond the basic necessities of life. And are we a richer culture for that? People working extra jobs to be able to provide all of these basic needs? People taken away from quality of family to be able to provide all of these needs? People being at the ragged edge of relationships all the time because there's so much stress to be able to make all these bills so that we can do all these things because this is just the American way? I don't believe that. Somebody's got to say, not me. I'm not going to do that. Now, if you got the financial resources to do it, go for it. But if you don't, you don't need to do that. Food, clothing, roof over your head, basic needs, anything above that is blessing. You don't have to do everything that our culture tells you to do. You can't do all of it. You've got to decide. There's a key equation here in this passage, and the key equation is this, that godliness, authentic relationship with God, plus contentment, an ability to live with our basic needs and be happy with everything else, that equals a rich life. That equals a rich life. It says, the Bible says, great gain. It's a rich life. And it doesn't matter if you're making a six-figure income or if you're making a very small income, if the economy's going up or if the economy's going down, if you have these two ingredients, godliness plus contentment, you're going to have a rich life. Your life is going to be filled with the things that really matter and the things that are really meaningful. If you choose to go in a different direction and make money more important than what it really is, here's what it will happen. This is what will ruin your life. What will ruin my life, I want you to notice, verse 9, he says, people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. Now the word there, the phrase there, people who want to, you can underline that in your Bible. That's kind of a weak translation in the English. The original Greek word really refers to a passion or a desire or a purpose. People who purpose to do this, they set out as their goal is the acquisition of money. That's what they're planning to do. That's what their purpose is. That's what they're doing. People who are determined to get lots of money can expect to fall into four negative things. In fact, he says it in the passage. He says, first of all, they'll fall into temptation. They'll start experiencing temptations that are not the same kind of temptations that people who don't have a purpose, a goal, a focus of getting money, they won't have that same temptations. They'll be tempted in lots of different ways. He doesn't list out what they are, but we could probably speculate on what they would be. Integrity issues, get-rich-quick schemes, willingness to roll the dice, climbing a ladder that puts family in jeopardy. There's just lots and lots and lots of temptations for a person who sets out as a mindset, I'm going to get rich. Now, you don't have to have a lot of money to make that your mindset. And your goal of what rich means is not defined here. So for you, getting rich may be a small amount of money. But if that's your focus, getting the money, they fall into temptation. Secondly, he says they fall into traps. People fall into traps. They get themselves in a bad place where they get caught up. They get snared. They get hooked into stuff that they don't want. Third, he says they fall into many foolish and harmful desires. They do stupid things. They do self-destructive things. They've got desires working within them that drive them to make stupid decisions, harmful decisions. Now, they may make great economic decisions. They may be brilliant at the balance sheet. They may be incredible at investing. But what about decisions related to life? And there are a lot of incredibly wealthy and incredibly brilliant men and women who've made a mess of their lives. He goes on to say that it will plunge them into ruin and destruction. It actually has a devastating effect on people. Now, that's not to say that if you have money, that that's been your goal in life, is to get money. There are a lot of people that their goal in life is to do a good job. They've done a good job, and along the way, they've acquired incredible prosperity. There's nothing wrong with that. What we're talking about is someone who sets out with a purpose focus that money is my goal and I'm going after it. Problem with that is once you do that, you're going to find that it will corrupt your view of things. You will begin to acquire things and ask of them to provide stuff for you that things can never provide. It will also corrupt your view of people. You will begin to look at people differently. You'll begin to see people as either obstacles to your success, someone to be emulated, someone to be envied. And that damages your relationship with people. A number of years ago, the famous poet Edwin Arlington Robinson wrote one of my favorite poems. It's entitled Richard Quarry. Let me share it with you, because I think oftentimes we think people who have it all, financially have it all. Whenever Richard Quarry went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. You know, we're on the pavement, he's on the sidewalk. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean-favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked, but still he fluttered pulses when he said good morning, and he glittered when he walked. And he was rich, yes, richer than a king, and admirably schooled in every grace. In fine, we thought he was everything to make us wish we were in his place. So on we worked, and we waited for the light, and we went without the meat, and we cursed the bread. And Richard Quarry, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head. Just because a person's got it doesn't mean they're happy. Because money doesn't make people happy. And the things that money buys will not make people happy in a real, true sense. We have a tendency to envy people, and envy is a damaging thing. Paul Eldridge's Maxims for Modern Man talks about envy. Let me give you some of them. He says, what we have not often poisons what we have. Our urge to acquire is less due to the passion to possess them than to the vanity of feeling superior to those who envy our possession of them. Here's my favorite one. Envy transmutes other people's base metals into gold. Isn't that good? Envy transmutes other people's base metals into gold. We have a tendency to look at what people have and think, if only I had that. And the people that have it are like, no big deal. Our envy is the yeast that swells the fortunes of others. No form of hatred is as keen as envy. It magnifies the importance of our enemy, and it belittles our own. When we envy someone else, we think they're big, and it makes us small. Determined to get lots of it will ruin your life. Secondly, what will ruin my life? Develop a love for it. Develop a love for it. He says in verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Says that a love of money, doesn't say money's the root of evil, says a love of money. If you love money, something happens in your heart. That money plants a seed in there, and the seed is bad. It's a bad seed. And it takes root in there, and it begins to grow, and what it produces in your life are negative things. Now, just like the root of a weed, you can actually cut off the branches, you can cut off the fruit, you can cut off the stalk. But if it's planted down deep in your heart, You've planted this evil seed of love of money. I just love it. I just have to have it. It just makes me happy. And it doesn't just, I'm not talking about the crisp dollar bill. I'm talking about the ability to acquire stuff, the ability to hold yourself with finances. If you love that, if that's what you live for, that's your passion, that's what your heart beats for, you cut that off and it's going to produce a new crop. You know, you might get rid of the credit cards and say, I'm done with all that frivolous spending. I'm not going to do that anymore. But if you love money, if that seed's planted, it'll spring up in some other area. You'll see it grow a new crop of fruit. Once that seed gets planted in there, it has to be rooted out. And the way we root it out is to change our focus. Godliness, not the goods of this world. Contentment, not satisfaction based on acquisition. That equals a powerful combination for real life, regardless of the economy, regardless of how much money you have or how much you don't have. That gives you life. Life that things can never give you. By way of application, let me make two suggestions for you. First of all, we need to appreciate what we have. You need to appreciate what you have. Take stock of what you have. Go through and look at your finances. Go through, look at what you own. And once you take out of the equation what you need for food and shelter, basic necessities, everything that's left over is blessing. It's blessing. Look at that. Take stock of what you have. Secondly, don't just spend, invest. Don't just spend, invest. In other words, what I'm suggesting to you is not that you would invest your money in some kind of a yield-bearing commodity. I'm talking about investing that every spending decision you make, you place a value on it. Oh, I'm spending this because I'm feeding my family. Or, you know, I'm spending this because I'm putting a roof over my head. Or I'm spending this because this is going to enable me to have a closer connection with my friends. Or I'm spending this to support a ministry that I believe in. But every decision that you make on the spending end has some kind of investment attached to it. And if you find that you have difficulty justifying a spending decision based on your values, what's important, what you believe God would have you do, ask yourself the question, well, then why am I spending money on this? Why would I put some money into something that really doesn't fit who I believe I am, what I believe is important, and what I think is right? Am I doing it because everybody else is doing it? Am I doing it because it feeds something in me that, you know, really shouldn't be fed? View every decision as an issue of investment, not just spending. I want to close by showing you a hat. This hat belonged to my grandfather, who died a little over a year ago. My grandfather always wore this hat, and you know, it went in season and or style and came out of style, but it didn't really matter because this was his hat. And I don't know how old this hat is because he wore it forever, just like everything else he had, seemed like. My grandfather survived the Depression, and he lived through World War II and many other conflicts that took place, a lot of economic up and downs, like the triple-digit misery index of the 1970s when the auto industry fell apart, and he lived in Michigan, worked in Michigan, and he went through all that time. And you know, I never noticed that my grandfather ever struggled with money. It was never an issue to him. My grandfather showed my dad his last pay slip. He was a tool and die maker. Showed my dad his last pay slip. The most he ever earned was $5.65 an hour. He died last year, so it's not forever ago. $5.65 an hour, which is roughly a little over $10,000 a year. And when he died, he had $400,000 in assets. You say, how do you do that? I don't know how he did it. I guess he wore this hat. And kept wearing it and wearing it and wearing it and wearing it. And he had that old Ford Fairlane station wagon that had 350,000 miles on it. And he just kept driving it and driving it and driving it. You know where he drove it? He played three musical instruments. He and my grandmother loved a square dance. And they traveled the state of Michigan going from one square dance club to another. And he played banjo, he played guitar, he played harmonica. They sang, they danced, they had a great time. They had a goal that their kids would see every state in the union while they were growing up, and so their vacations consisted of getting in the car, putting the tent in, and driving. So he toured all over the United States, had an incredibly full life, died at a ripe old age with money in the bank, lived through the economic worst times of this country, and had a great life. And if he could do that on $10,000 a year, what can you do on 40 or 60? And some of you are having a lot of trouble on 100 and 150. Why is that? Well, ask yourself the question, what's my formula for living? Godliness plus contentment is a rich life. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, as we come before you, we recognize that tough times cause refocus in our priorities. And Father, if you desire for our economy to struggle and for that to affect us, give us the courage to be willing and eager to meet the day, knowing that in each and every situation that we face, that you are God and that life does not consist in things. Father, teach us to trust you and to embrace that which is truly life indeed. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.